Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. And we did a little dancing to the
tune. Yes, you did. You know, last Friday, speaking of...
There should be a little more music, though, Marjorie. You had just started to...
just started to warm up there.
Yeah, speaking of that, you know, last Friday, Marjorie, you and I had singer-songwriter Livingston Taylor in the studio, and he sang, and it was beautiful. Today, we're joined by another noted local crooner with some promise. Listen to this.
Don't do this.
Here it is.
And budgets, they're killers. Senators, judges, they're thrillers. Whatever, I love it all.
So if this doesn't work out,
off key there.
No, you were. That was pretty good. That was pretty good.
It's a good cause.
Band in Boston.
Band in Boston, Urban Improv. They, as you know, work on issues around youth violence and giving kids tools to avoid violence and when it starts to escalate. And they do really, really great work. And every year they have a big fundraiser, and Diane and I have participated for the last 6 or 7 years.
So were you in the a cappella group at Harvard or anything?
No. I was in the shower. That's where whatever I have comes from.
That's the voice of Governor Deval Patrick. He's with us once a month. He is here today till 1 o'clock to take your questions. The number is 877-301-8970.
Can I just say I decry that kind of ambush journalism.
And you can email them to BPR, as in Boston Public Radio, at WGBH.com. .org, or you can tweet them to BOS Boston Public Radio.
So the big news today, Governor, the House lawmakers passed this $500 million...
What?
transportation bill on Monday. They didn't get enough votes, though, to override your veto. You, of course, wanted close to $2 billion, transportation improvements, new transportation, fix the bridges, and education improvements,
yes.
specifically early child education stuff.
Right.
So what happens now, veto-wise or bill-wise or future-wise?
It's a process, Marjorie. You know, the House put their bill out a week ago, and they voted on it yesterday, as you said. And I think there were a number of people on both sides of the question who were not entirely sure about what was in the bill, what was paid for, and what was not. We were convinced in my administration that what the bill bought was an improvement in the balance sheet at the T and at the RTAs, but not an improvement in the experience of people using our transportation system, and that it was an awful lot to ask people to pay more and basically get nothing or little from it. But, you know, the question to me is not whether this or some other bill is perfect. The question is what it is we're willing to invest in. And what I've been urging and fighting for is some lasting good in our transportation system. How do we make it modern and functional and up to a leading edge economy as we're trying to build here? And how do we do lasting good in education? We've got a lot to say for it, but there's a whole lot more to do.
Our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to speak to the governor about the budget kerfuffle on Beacon Hill or anything else. Governor, I was sort of surprised. Terry Murray, the Senate president, and Speaker DeLeo came out with this plan mid last week. You were kind enough to call us on Friday, and you said you hadn't spoken to the speaker since that came out.
Haven't.
By the way, it almost is incredible to me. And is this because you've made overtures and he's rebuffed them, or why haven't you talked?
Well, first of all, I have to respect the legislative process, and the speaker has been working to get his votes, and he's got his time. He has devoted his time to that. I've been as clear as I can, both publicly and privately, that I'm open to private conversation, that I'm interested in compromise. And I've said that, you know, before they announced their proposal last week. I've even floated alternative numbers. I think there's probably a place we could land that's between where the House bill is and where I started. That's a good place where we could do some lasting good both in transportation and in education, and I think there'll be opportunities for us to work toward that. I hope there are before we reach a final conclusion.
On the transportation, though, with such a wide divide, they're approving $500 million, you wanting close to $2 billion.
I'm sorry. Your question, then I just want to clarify
okay,
what the delta
is there. I just want to know what we're not going to get.
So So let me answer your question.
If it stays where it is.
Yeah, let me answer your question, and then I want to come back.
Okay.
Or maybe I'll start with the 1.9 that I proposed is $1 billion for transportation and $900 million for education.
Education.
Okay. What they have what the House voted on yesterday was $500 million for transportation. They have not offered any new revenue for education, and I don't think they want to take separate revenue or tax votes. So I think that from the House's point of view, or at least from the perspective of yesterday's vote, not only do you not get the 30,000 kids on the wait list for early education off those wait lists or make college more affordable for middle-class families through the MAS Grants program, but you don't get new red line cars. They're 40 years old right now. You don't get a replacement of the 100-year-old electricity system at the T. You don't get new orange line cars. You don't get out-of-date buses on the RTAs replaced. You don't get South Coast Rail, 700,000 people who are cut off from the economic activity in the greater Boston area, and all the people here cut off from the affordable housing in the South Coast. You don't get the Green Line extension, at least at an affordable level, because actually what you invest in the good repair of the T affects our ability to qualify for federal help to finish the Green Line. So it makes the cost of doing the Green Line, which is a legal obligation, twice as high as it would be, which means practically it's not going to get done. So there are a whole host of projects. You know, we did maps. Remember, our plan was very data-driven, and we took a whole year to build it. I know Secretary Davey has been on the program with you before and talked about the process and what was involved. We did it because the legislature asked us to do it, indeed directed us to do it. We did scores of hearings around the Commonwealth. We brought in thousands of people from writers to economists and business leaders and cost estimators and so on. So it was built up project by project. Not every project everybody wanted was on that list, but the business of modernizing was central to the list and the regular update, and that was about 80% of what we proposed. And then a handful of strategic other projects that would unlock economic growth. So we got to that $1 billion for transportation in a very data-driven way. And then we created maps that showed exactly where the investments would be in everybody's district and put those out. So basically, none of those projects, if the House bill is the final version, gets done.
Just a couple of questions before we get to Kohl's, Governor Patrick. And again, our number is 877-301-8970. You said you did float some numbers by, I assume, House and Senate leaders. What kind of numbers did you float between $1.9 billion and $500 million?
Well, you know, you keep tempting me to do the negotiation here on the air.
But it was halfway? Did you meet him halfway?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a number that is halfway between where I started and where the House bill is, where we can do a lot of good.
So one of the things I'm not clear on, Governor, is the 500 – you were threatened to veto the $500 million if that's what the end product is. But as you know better than I, part of the 55 votes, there were no votes, are not people who want more spending like you do and more investment, but there are approximately 30 Republicans who want no new revenues mm-hmm. and say you can do it through reform, et cetera. So rather than taking the risk of vetoing it and ending up with nothing, which is a possibility, why just strategically not decide, let's use the $500 million as a starting point, get the repairs and the maintenance done, and then we'll continue to lobby for the expansion money rather than risking everything?
So first of all, the $500 million doesn't buy the repairs and the maintenance, and that's very important to see. What the $500 million does is solve the T's operating deficit. it enables the patches to be done. And it makes it improves the balance sheets of the RTAs, the regional transit authorities, by so-called forward funding, which you remember was the be-all and end-all mm-hmm. solution for the T, remember, when they did that a few years ago. It's not a be-all and end-all solution. What it basically says is to the RTAs, you get your state allowance at the beginning of the year instead of at the end of the year. There's some advantages to that. We proposed it. But the idea that $500 million, as big a number as that is, get you modern cars, get you, you know, the red line door, the red line car,
whose
doors
were
open while it was moving.
Yeah.
You know, thank God that wasn't at rush hour when everybody's cheek by jowl on the red line. That doesn't get replaced. The problem is that you're asking people everywhere in the Commonwealth to pay more money. You're taxing everybody at $500 million and not actually delivering anything for them at home. The reason I think that is bad policy, I hope, is plain. But the reason I think that's bad politics is at that level, the legislature is going to be back here in a few years. And you and everybody else are going to say, what the heck happened? You just asked us for more money for $500 million, and I don't see any change. How come we're back? And so I say, look, let's make it a long-term fix. It doesn't have to be dollar for dollar what I proposed. But let's have a real solution instead of a patch where we all kind of pretend it's a real solution and take a bow.
So you're not worried – last question before the – so you're not worried that if you do exercise a veto and it is sustained, that Bob DeLeo, just for example, as a speaker, says, Governor, there's no compromise to be talked about. If you want to come back to me and say you'll take $500 million, we'll vote for it again. But that's as far as my members are going to go.
I mean, I appreciate that that's a risk, but I just don't see it happening. And the reason – it's not that I underestimate the speaker. He's a very strong, very able leader and someone I'm very fond of, as I think you know. The same is true with the Senate president. But I think that the reason we are having this debate at all is because they're listening to the same constituents I am, the same business leaders I am, the same advocates I am, who are saying now is the time for us to have to invest in our transportation system, not just the T, but to do it in a way that's equitable across the whole of the Commonwealth. And I don't think people are going to put up with, you know, this sort of devolving into some sort of personal thing among the leadership on Beacon Hill.
Well, one last question for me before we get to the calls. You talk about the reform issue, and you talk about I was surprised, frankly, that almost half of the people in the Boston Herald poll said they were ready for raise these taxes for infrastructure and transportation and education. And yet you hear the same people, a lot of Republicans, saying, well, you know, how about the reform part? How about, you know, losing $28 million and overpaying in food stamps and stuff like that? And you hear a lot of people griping about that kind of stuff. How much do you think that hurts you with these representatives that have to go back and explain to their constituents?
Well, the question is not how much it hurts me, much it hurts. It hurts the case, I guess.
It hurts the case.
And I think that, look, some of that is real. Some of it's made up. I mean, it's cited by people who aren't going to vote to make these investments under any circumstances. I think the alternative that you saw from the Republicans, which I think was represented as a reform measure, actually didn't have any new stuff in it. It was and we've had several reforms. I mean, leaving aside the big steps that the legislature helped us with a few years ago in collapsing all these agencies into one, and the, I think, nearly $500 million we saved in the course of that in the first few years, there's a whole other raft of reforms in how we operate that have been pending in the legislature for some time. And they ought to be taken up and made a part of this bill. That's totally key. But the point, the business of, you know, in a large organization, public or private, and I've worked in both, there is always room for improvement, always. There's always going to be the business of squeezing out the nonsense. We've got a very, very strong record of doing precisely that. But we're not done. And when I leave, there'll be still more for the next governor and the governor after that and the governor after that to do. But it's also apparent to me, Marjorie, that there is no amount of that that is going to buy us a modern transportation system. There is still a need for new taxes. And last thing I would say, you cited the poll in the Herald. I think there were two others as well, where the public support is even larger.
Yeah.
And what people are saying, they're not saying, look, go with the governor's plan. That's not the point. What they're saying is, let's have a comprehensive solution. Yeah, I'd be willing to pay a little bit more income tax, maybe not as much as the governor proposed, but a little bit more if we can really get from that a modern transportation system and a modern education system. And that's what I think is worth fighting for.
Let's go to the calls. It's 877-301-8970. That's Governor Deval Patrick with us until 1 o'clock. Governor.
Yes, let's see. Jack is calling from Andover. Jack, you there?
Hi, Jack.
Hi, how are you?
Good Excellent. Morning. Or afternoon, I'm sorry.
I have a question. Under your original plan, you were going to take away the credit for the capital gains on the sale of the house, the septic tank update, which is $6,000, lead paint, $1,500, college credit, which fortunately my kids are out of college.
Tuition, yep.
Yes, I have a question. Theoretically, if I sell my house, I could lose $7,500 in credit for my septic tank update and lead removal, not counting what I'll have to pay extra in capital gains. I'm assuming, I don't know what the capital gains would be, but I'm assuming it could be $10,000 to $20,000.
For your sake, I hope so.
Well, that wouldn't be my tax I'm talking about.
No, I know.
And I could end up having to pay $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 in one sale of one house. How can that be fair to the middle class?
It's a great question, Jack, and I have two responses. The first is that the personal exemptions were doubled in the plan I made. So for most people, it's a wash, and it's a lot more efficient way to do it. Basically, everybody gets the benefit, and you don't have to file as much paper. And as a practical matter, it's a wash. As a second point, I would say that's basically off the table at this point. If there's a compromise, I don't think that, or frankly, any of the other personal exemptions that we proposed eliminating would be on the table. Because I just don't think. For a couple of reasons, not the least of which is there isn't the appetite for doubling the personal exemption, which was the counterweight for those things. And if we don't double the personal exemption, then you do take a hit if those personal deductions are eliminated. So if we're not going to do the two things in tandem, I'd just say take that part of the proposal and put it on the shelf.
Jack, thanks for the call. Governor, there were reports you called as many as 100 members of the House of Representatives on the phone over the weekend. And the Republican, the chair of the Republican Party, whose name escapes me for a moment, put out a release in the last 24 hours saying that you said to legislators that if they chose to vote against your package, and I'm paraphrasing, they should not expect transportation projects in their district. Did you say that to them?
Well, first of all, I think we called – first of all, I didn't make all the calls. Our team called, and I think even more than that.
Mm-hmm.
But I was talking earlier in response to Marjorie's question about the maps, the maps that are up online on mass.gov that show where the projects are that would come under our transportation program. And those don't happen if the House bill is the final version. They just don't happen. So that's a matter of fact. That's not a matter of discretion.
But you didn't say to an individual, or did you say to an individual representative or one of your people, say, if there's inadequate money by your standards, if it comes up somewhere short of $1 billion and there are decisions to be made, that your discretion will be exercised in such a way that a no voter doesn't get a project?
No.
Okay, let's go back to...
No, but let me be really, really clear about this. We're not talking about having discretion if the House bill is the final bill. It's not about whether we're going to choose to do this project over here and not that one over there. The projects on those maps are funded by the proposal I made. And if we have $500 million with the instructions that the House bill gives us, we're not going to get to those modernization projects.
Let's go back to the calls, Governor Deval Patrick.
Let's see. Dave is calling from Falmouth. Dave, you there?
Good afternoon, Governor.
How are you, Dave?
I'm doing well.
Good.
I'm doing well. We could be doing a little better down here, but we're doing all right, and we're looking forward to a great season.
Good.
My question for you today is, are there other areas you think we should be looking for funding for decommissioning our turbines here? We're having an awful time here.
I've heard that.
We're having trouble raising the money. The people We've got to put this project behind us.
Yeah.
And I have a second question for you, too. Would it be possible to switch them and go to the original plan with the 660s and try to get the wrecks that way. And that way it would keep you happy, and it would keep the folks in the neighborhood happy.
So, Dave, maybe you should say for other listeners what the project is about. Should we take a minute about just what the issue is?
Yeah,
you're talking about those two older turbines, right?
Yes, at the wastewater facility.
It's two of them, right?
We originally were scheduled for the 660 kilowatts, which, in my opinion, is proper siting and proper sizing. That's my opinion,
mm-hmm.
and that's how I feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up with 1.65 megawatt huge industrial turbines that are just wreaking havoc on all the neighbors, their health, their children, everybody suffering.
They're not working very well, are they, right? I mean,
No, we've had some serious problems.
Right.
We've had some maintenance problems. And but we're stuck. We're really in a bind, and we really could use some help.
Well, I know. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I don't want.
No, I was just going to say. I know that Secretary Sullivan, Energy and Environment, Environmental Affairs Secretary, has been down working with town fathers and mothers on some way that the state can help with that solution. I know there have been issues with abutters and one question about how, maybe it's not just abutters, but one question about how close they were sited. When Falmouth decided to put them in, how close they put them to where people live. I had understood that there were some maintenance issues as well. and I think that at least one of them is – I think there's a consensus needs to come down. I don't know whether both, but at least one. Am I remembering this right, Dave?
Yes. But we feel that both of them have to come down.
Do you? Yeah.
The health effects and the flicker and the no sleep for these people, it's just not working out.
Right.
And both of them really have to come down.
Yeah.
But, we're exhausted. We're tired.
Yeah, you sound it.
For 3 years.
You sound it.
You know, 3 years of fighting and trying to get some solutions going. And I think we're due. We're due for some help, Governor.
Well, like I said,
Falmouth needs some love. We need a little love.
Okay,
well, Dave, thanks for the call.
Dave, I'm sending love through this microphone and through Secretary Sullivan, who I know has been working to try to get a solution. Let's see if we can't close on it soon. I'll ask him about it when we finish the show.
Dave, for those who want more information on this, Emily Rooney did a great piece on this last night in Greater Boston
about
Falmouth and the two sides on the wind turbines. This is a great email from Ellen. And Ellen, I have thought of this a million times. Mm-hmm. Here we go, Governor. Why does Massachusetts insist on not allowing tabs to lock the handle on gas pumps? When you pump gas in Massachusetts, you have to stand there and squeeze the handle the entire time.
I know.
Yeah. You're in charge, Governor Patrick.
He sounds surprised.
You can snap your fingers.
Funny you say that.
In the wintertime, right?
Yeah, it's freezing. We used to have them, I feel, or did I? Was I just experiencing this someplace else?
I don't know.
I feel like we used to have
But I thought of that in the wintertime. Your hand is freezing. Standing, if you've got a big car, you're standing there. Well, we're going to look into this, Ellen. Maybe we'll pass this on.
I didn't know that this is a state regulation.
She says it's a state law. I have no idea.
Okay.
This is Ask the Governor, Governor.
Okay, but that doesn't mean the governor has to answer. It's not answer from the governor.
But it's not true that you personally remove these little
tabs
from every gas handle.
But I am curious. But you're going to send us the emails,
right? We will send you. We've got a lot of good emails.
So we'll tell Ellen we'll get back to her.
Okay, by the way, the email address, if you have further questions, bpr@wgbh.org. And by the way, we should have said this whole hour with the governor is being streamed live. If you want to watch it, you go to wgbhnews.org. Governor, we spent almost...
So you want me to stop making faces?
No, you can keep making them if you choose. We have spent almost the whole hour talking about transportation and the $500 million rather than a billion. This legislature, at least in this round, the two leaders zeroed out your request for $900 million for early education and higher ed and a whole variety of things. Tomorrow, the House budget comes out. Do you have any information or hope that any of your education initiatives that were not funded are funded in this House budget tomorrow?
Well, I'm interested. I don't know what's going to be in the House budget. It's hard for me to see how they do it because I've looked at the budget without the new revenue, and we've had experiences now of, you know, cutting stuff and moving things around, and you know, some of it has helped, But the question is, are we going to do lasting good? Are we really going to say to these 3- and 4-year-olds who are on wait lists, no, you wait until we feel like we ought to invest in you? And I look, this is about, you know, I've heard the leadership talk about their concern for the middle class, and I think that concern is genuine, and I share it. But I think the middle class benefits from having the best educated workforce and a growing economy. I think the middle class benefits from having their kids able to afford college by getting the Mass Grant program, which has lost 3/4 of its buying power in the last 20 years, restored. I think having public colleges and universities that are actually affordable for middle class families is a benefit to the middle class. So I do think these are things worth fighting for. And like I said, it doesn't have to be my way of doing it, but we ought to do it, and we have a moment to do so.
Governor, the thing I'm obsessed with, I'm sorry, and I'll try to control myself after this. You meet with the Senate president and the House speaker weekly, do you not? Just the three of you, or biweekly or something?
Yeah, it's supposed to be weekly. It's been off.
So
lately.
I asked you briefly about this when you called in on Friday. Bob DeLeo told me and others a month ago that he knew nothing about your revenue proposal until he heard you give a speech. You then told reporters you knew nothing about their proposal, their $500 million proposal, until an hour before it was released. What happens at these meetings? I mean, do you not? I don't mean this critically at all. I mean it as an observation.
It's a great question.
Do you not say to them, by the way, you've had my $2 billion package for a couple of, what are you guys going to do on this thing? I mean, isn't, what's the point of the meetings if not that?
It's a great question. I mean, we have sometimes the meetings are very, very pointed. I mean, we have an understanding that we keep the substance of those meetings confidential. But I can tell you that sometimes we are very specific and we're working stuff out, and sometimes we're not. And the whole question, you know, do you remember when the it's so interesting when people have quoted back to me what the speaker said about not knowing my proposal until
he said it to me.
No,
by the
way. I understand that, and I'm not going to pick a quarrel on the air. But you know, the speaker went to the chamber and made a speech about how his bill was going to be significantly smaller, and that's the first I heard of that, and then we didn't know what that meant until the bill came out. The proposal came out last week. Some of this I understand, and I think you and your listeners should as well. People want to be able to control their own announcement, right? They don't want a lot of stuff about it before it's out, and I totally get that. We are in a process now, and it's a legislative process which I have come to understand and respect. And there'll be a lot of back and forth with the leadership and with the members as we get to the end. And that's why I haven't given up hope.
Fair enough. That's the voice of Governor Deval Patrick. Back to the phones at 877-301-8970.
Let's see. Ashley is calling from Lemonster. Ashley, you there?
Hello, Governor. How are you?
I'm okay. How about you?
Good. I just want to let you know that I'm a 7-year seasonal employee for the Massachusetts Department of Conservation and Recreation.
All right.
I worked my first 4 years as a seasonal at Walden, and I think it's a great education tool. For the past 3 years,
Ashley,
I've been
where did you say you worked? You broke up
a
little bit there. You
worked at Walden Pond.
Oh, great. Yeah. Were you there when we came out to do the stocking?
Yes, I was.
All right.
Yeah, definitely. It's really great, and it's a great tool for the city of Boston, a way to get kids out onto the lake and the great programs. But for the past 3 years, you know, our seasons have been cut shorter. A lot of positions have been cut.
Right.
And I'm also trying to look for a teaching job, and neither of them look promising. And I just don't know what to do because I'm 26 and my health insurance is out at the end of the month.
Mm-hmm. You're still on your parents' health insurance?
Until the 30th, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm looking for a position that's going to be longer. I don't want to get unemployment I ever have in my off seasons. I'm just not finding a solution for a state job that I would really love to do, either teaching our kids or continuing to work for the Parks Department.
Yeah.
And I want to know what the budget's going to look like if this fall I should start looking in other states to be a teacher.
Ashley, thanks for the call. We got to let you go only because the connection is bad. Governor?
I think I got the essence of Ashley's question. First of all, Ashley, thank you for your service at Walden Pond. That is important. And you are exactly right. Budgets have been cut right through the worst of the recession in almost every respect, with the exception being healthcare and education. And when I say education, I mean the Chapter 70 formula, which is the principal way that the state supports local schools. But even in many school districts, because of shortfalls in what municipalities can raise, they have made cuts in education. So what happens in the coming budget, I think we'll see a lot more, have a lot more insight tomorrow, I think it is, when the House announces their budget proposal. And that's a process too, and we'll be working on that right through the 1st of July.
We're talking to Governor Deval Patrick. He's going to be with us until the top of the hour. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7. Quick break, and we'll come right back with more of your calls to Governor Deval Patrick.
Where to live, what to do, these are the challenges that face Cape Cod if it's going to attract and retain young people and families.
I think a community cannot strive and go forward without a good quality base of children. We're not a Sun City. We're not the Villages of Florida. We are Mashpee.
I'm reporter Sean Corcoran. Our series on the graying of Cape Cod concludes tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition.
We love our contributors. That means you. And Orchestra of Indian Hill. Maestro Bruce Hangin conducts Beethoven and Rachmaninoff, featuring pianist Maxim Mogilevsky, Saturday, April 13th at 7:30 p.m. in Littleton. More at IndianHillMusic.org. And Frontline, presenting an intimate portrait of Syria, a once peaceful nation, now fiercely divided. Don't miss Syria Behind the Lines from Frontline, Tuesday at 10 on WGBH 2.
We are back with Governor Deval Patrick. He joins us once a month and you once a month for an hour in studio. And by the way, you can watch him and you can watch, I believe, the back of my head if you choose at WGBH.
Oh, is that the camera?
That is the camera. You can wave to it or do whatever. There he is. That's the governor if you weren't sure which one he was. You can watch the whole thing at WGBHnews.org.
Governor Patrick, you have a big fan. Richard emails in. He wants to know what's the most effective way for a plain old citizen to impact our Beacon Hill Glacier and tell them your $1.9 billion plan is necessary. What did he do, call his legislator?
Well, the most important thing to do is to call both your House rep and your senator. I say both because the senators take it up on Thursday. And we are working with a number of senators now to to try to vet some of their own ideas about alternatives. And to talk to your House rep, because it isn't over. It'll come back. In a couple of different ways. It'll come back even if, there's just a little bit of difference between the House and the Senate, because then they'll have to have a conference and all the members will have to vote on it again. And we're going to stay engaged. I think the other thing to do is record your views with the Office of the Senate President and of the Speaker. They keep track of that too.
Richard, I understand 10 calls is like a tsunami of phone calls up there in Beacon Hill. So I get a few of your neighbors to call.
That's
and then
exactly
you get a big,
right. Thank you.
Get a big result. By the way, the number is 617-722-2000.
That's not the number. Oh, wait a minute.
That's the number for the State House.
Oh, okay. All right. Fine.
Yeah, so
I thought you were giving the number for the station.
No. There used to be a real person answering the phone, but there isn't anymore. I guess that was a budget thing too. But anyway, I want to ask you about something else besides the budget for just a second, because I find this sort of fascinating. I'm sure you've been following a little bit the Senate race between Steve Lynch and Ed Markey, the two congressmen, want to replace John Kerry. This guy, Tom Steyer, he's a big rich guy from California, big environmentalist, doesn't like the Keystone Pipeline. So he's been sort of trailing.
Oh, I heard about this.
Yeah. Yesterday at Fenway Park and all over the place, he's been trailing Steve Lynch. Lynch, like Barack Obama, is waiting for the final report to come in on the Keystone Pipeline, whether it's going to be terrible. Lynch wants it because of the jobs. But this guy, who's got a lot of money, Steyer, is arguing that he's taking a page out of what big oil does and big electricity. They lobby, lobby, lobby with money. He's got a lot of money. Signs in Fenway yesterday. Steve Lynch, you know, in pocket of big oil and evil Steve Lynch and stuff like that.
Geez.
What do you think of those tactics? Is outside money coming in like that?
Well, you know what I think. This is a statewide race. It's a Massachusetts race. I hope we keep it supported by people from Massachusetts and about Massachusetts, at least at this phase. You know, the Keystone's a tough issue for a lot of people.
Yep.
I think the I don't pretend to be an expert on it, so I'm getting a little out of my depth. But the president's interest in waiting for this report so that he can have as much data before he makes a decision seems to me to be. To be wise.
But the star argument is that he's combating what big lobbyists are able to do, what big industries are able to do. He's like the Koch brothers
of the
left.
I don't like all the whole thing after the whole, you know, what'd you say, tsunami of
phone
of
calls
money
up to Beacon Hill?
After Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision is deeply troubling to me. The fact that wealthy interests can so influence the way people think about their own civic lives. And of course, the problem I think in the medium term, not even in the long term, is that we get to be so awash in stuff. Nobody believes anything, and they tune out. So I think it may be counterproductive in the end in terms of the strength of the democracy. But
who are you voting for in the primary?
I think it's a secret ballot. Am I wrong?
No, I believe it. So the answer is we're not going to hear it. 877-301-8970. Governor Patrick, back to the phones, please.
Let's see. George is calling from JP. George.
Hello, Governor.
How are you?
I'm fine. Marjorie and Jim might remember me as I'm the father of the swan boat driver. He's a teenager.
Oh, yes. We do, George.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Governor?
Yes.
Stand firm. Veto that bill. And tell them that you're going to run again. And I say that is because I read the op-ed piece in the Globe today, and it got me thinking. The problem with term limits is the lame duck thing. So you know, you can run again. We don't have term limits, and veto the bill. Show Obama what it's like to be, have some conviction with your thing. I say that because my son uses the T all the time.
Yeah.
I'm handicapped a little. I need the tea. And I'm right in JP. It's those orange lines. The orange line is 25 years old. They haven't painted it, fixed it, replaced the windbreakers. And the cars are completely breaking down.
Yeah.
The wires are burning up.
They're rotting out from underneath.
Yeah. And Governor, I've always wondered, didn't you ever have a campaign platform that said, look, we had 16 years of Republican governors that never painted, fixed, or repaired a bridge during those 16 years? The Charles River crossings, look at them. They let them crumble. They even stole, you know, the artwork on it. I'm just saying.
We're fixing it
now.
It's
not your fault. You're trying to do something that we all, and go by the polls, we want this. We want a better transit system. I want to go to Fall River. By the purple line. You
hey,
know
George.
I mean?
George, we thank you. If I may, we just thank you for your call. I want to ask something off George, though, if I may, Governor.
You want me to answer George's?
Yeah, but part of it, I think, is there is a lot of speculation from pundits of all stripes that one of the reasons you're in this mess with the legislature, you're not running for re-election. 99% of them are running for re-election. You put any stock into that lame duck argument in terms of your side of the equation?
No, I don't. I think, first of all, George, I appreciate your support. And if I've been clear, if the bill comes to me in the form it was voted on last night, I will veto it. I think there are a lot of steps between now and then, and I think there are a lot of opportunities to find common ground before we get to that point. And I'm certainly open to it, more than open to it, eager. For it, for the reasons George also said, which is that we're not talking about luxuries, we're talking about things people need. We're past the wants. We're talking about what people need, what the economy needs, what the jobs that get created from these kinds of investments, and the lives that get improved for all of us. There was a piece in today's Globe that talked about where the economic growth has been.
Is that it?
Yes.
Letting the Tea Crumble.
Exactly.
Yeah.
By Paul McMurrow, who wrote a longer...
I've circled all the places where the economic growth is happening.
Do you want to hold that up for the camera? There was a longer piece he wrote in Commonwealth Magazine, which independently evaluated the competitiveness of our tax system as it is today and as it would be under the original proposal I made. And I think the term he used is that we have been stubbornly average for a long time in the Commonwealth, and what I have proposed doesn't change that in material ways. But even if we don't do what I propose, we've got to figure out right now some way to modernize our transportation and education systems, because that is a key to the speed and pace and, frankly, the inclusiveness of our growth. So by the way, I really do believe that the legislative leadership and their members get that. I really do believe it. And one of the first things I was advised by a senior person in the House is, if you wanted to do this, you got to go out and sell it. And that's, you know, we've been out everywhere, me and my team, talking to folks, responding to questions, talking to editorial pages and so forth. And so, you know, Marjorie, you were as surprised as anybody when the first poll
came out from the Herald
and people said, actually, we prefer a comprehensive solution where there's a modest increase in the income tax to a narrow solution that is basically about the gas tax. Two other polls have said the same. I don't try to make decisions based on polls, but it is a barometer of how you're doing in terms of convincing people about the worthiness of this. So when folks say, well, you know, you got to – this is a long way around to your question, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
When folks say, well, you got to think about the politics of this, I don't get the politics that says we have won or are winning public opinion, editorial opinion, what have you. Let's ignore all that and do something else that raises everybody's taxes, but nobody feels improvements as a result of it. I just don't get those politics.
The number is 877-301-8970 if you want to speak to the governor. Again, it's 877-301-8970.
Yeah, I'm making a case for you, Governor, but one of the things he says, McMurrow, in this piece that you referred to, is that a lot of these big companies are coming into Kendall Square. They're coming into the waterfront district, and they employ a lot of young people who want to be able to get around at night on the T. And of course, we all know the T closes, what is it, 12:30?
Can we talk about business for a second, then we'll get back to the calls at 877-301-8970. I think I'm right, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong. The Boston Chamber of Commerce and the Associated Industries of Massachusetts, I think in the last couple of days, has endorsed the legislature's plan. But at the same time, this 2007, this bipartisan business-backed Transportation Finance Commission had said that we need $1 billion, very similar to you, we need $1 billion a year for 20 years. So what's your response to the Boston Chamber and Associated Industries,
which should
be more more engaged in your thing than mere mortals?
I scratched my head a little bit when I read those statements. And you know, I would presume, and I'm just guessing, I would presume that they are concerned that if the $500 million plan that the House has voted on gets vetoed, then they'll be back at zero and there won't be anything. But, you know, as I've said, with $500 million, it's a lot of money. It's a big vote, right? So make it count. And while we also proposed to do things that would improve balance sheets and eliminate operating deficits at the T and the RTAs, that isn't the stuff that the average rider, the George's son, or George for that matter, is going to see or experience when they take the T. And if you're down in the South Coast and you've been promised a rail connection for 30 years – and I don't know if you've ever been on 24, on Route 24 mm-hmm. during rush hour.
Terrible.
Right. And by the way, the days of being able to widen Route 24, those are over. That's not on. We don't have the margin to be able to do that. You got a workforce down there that needs the kind of jobs we have up here, and a workforce up here that needs the kind of housing that they have. I don't understand how you support a plan that doesn't have this in there. We have legal obligations to build the Green Line that my predecessor committed the Commonwealth to. And when I say committed, I don't mean just said it's a nice thing to do and let's do it, but actually signed a document settling claims about mitigation after the Big Dig as a result of it, but without a means to pay for it. We got to step up.
Speaking of signing a document, before we go back to the coals, another thing that you have embraced as a jobs-producing thing is obviously this casino legislation, and the Gaming Commission is now in place. The Gaming Commission came close to voting to opening the Southeast region to commercial bids as opposed to giving an exclusive to the Mashpee Wampanoags, who you've negotiated a deal with. And apparently at their next meeting on the 19th, they very well might do this. The lawyer who represents the tribe says that the language in the agreement that you worked out with the tribe prohibits the commission, quote, from opening the Southeast to commercial companies unless the tribe is unable to get its land in a federal trust, no matter how long it takes. Do you agree with that interpretation?
Well, I'm not going to get into the interpretation of the compact. I think the compact speaks for itself, and I think that it's the statute that says that commission has to make a determination that they are unlikely to get their land in trust before they can open it to commercial bidders. But I think what the commission is expressing is something a lot of people are feeling, which is, you know, when are we going to get on with it?
Are you one of the people that has that feeling?
Well, I think it's important. It was incredibly frustrating, Jim, to have the Bureau of Indian Affairs reject the first compact, something that we worked very hard to make as much like the terms of the statute as possible. It moved through the legislature pretty promptly, and we went down and presented a unified front to the Bureau, and the Bureau, in what I thought was a really irritating opinion, said, "Well, that may be what you want and what you think, but it's not how we do things." Sort of makes you say, "Well, then, how come you didn't just tell us what you wanted us to do in the first place? You saved everybody a lot of time." So we went back to the drawing board. They have given us a lot of technical assistance in this round. We've asked them, does this seem right? You know, they don't want to say yes or no, but they point in whether we're moving in the right direction. I think we have a good deal now, and it's before the legislature. And the sooner they take it up, the better, because then the tribe can present it to the Bureau. And the Bureau has a statutory time bind; they have to make a decision within 45 days, so it needn't drag on forever.
But would you be distressed if the Gaming Commission did vote on the 19th to open it to commercial?
Well, the tribe's going to be distressed, and the thing to appreciate here is that under existing federal law, I think I have this right. When the tribe gets their land in trust, they can do a Class 2 gaming facility, which is everything except the table games, without any permission at all. And if we don't have a compact in place, then the state doesn't get a cut of it. So having that, first of all, you know, the saturation in the region is not good. It's not good for the state. It's not good for the competitor private facility. There's a lot of reasons why the legislature needs to move this compact soon, and the commission should wait. But I don't get a vote in that. That's up to the. Up to the commission. I think they'll come to the right decision in the end.
Let's go back to the calls. Governor Deval Patrick.
Let's see. Patty is calling from Foxborough. Patty, you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Governor.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good.
I was wondering about your position on the moratorium on waste to energy, where we use trash as a fuel to make renewable electricity in Massachusetts.
I kind of like that idea. I think the moratorium, Patty, I think is on incineration. Am I right? On burning trash?
You know, incineration is an icky word. It's sort of like call me a broad or a chick. They you know,
Well, I'm not going to go there. but I if I understood it correctly, there has been a moratorium on burning garbage for a long time. But there are new technologies that enable a breakdown of waste into energy through technologies that are not burning. And that seems to me to make sense. And I think
it's so much less efficient than using it as a fuel. That it has to follow a strong recycling program. I'm not at all saying that recycling shouldn't come first. It should.
Right, right. I think Secretary Sullivan has got some new regs he's been floating, or at least some new ideas he's been floating in this direction, that doesn't do violence to the burning energy concern people have, but does allow for some of these new technologies that go from waste to energy. Is that, have you been following that stuff?
Following it, I'm employed by it.
Okay. Do you work for me?
What's the answer to that, Patty?
Well, I work for you in a heartbeat. I can take a pay cut. Not a problem.
Patty, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
On a semi-related note, Governor, an email, or Tina emailed and said, is at bpr@wgbh.org. Is there anything you can do to help close the Pilgrim Nuclear Station? A disaster at the plant would affect the South Shore and the city of Boston.
Yeah, the short answer is no. Nuclear Energy Resource, I forget the name of the federal agency.
Yeah, NRC or something. NRC, whatever, yeah.
Has exclusive jurisdiction. I think the only state where the state has some say over the siting or the relicensing of a nuclear facility is Vermont, which had a reservation of rights at the time.
And a very old power plant. Too.
And a very old power plant. Years. Actually, right across the line from us, as you know. We got involved. Did you say it was Tina?
Tina, yeah, that's who emailed.
Tina, we got involved in the relicensing, particularly right after the Fukushima disaster, to try to make sure that they were asking the questions that of the operator that were raised by the failure there in Japan. And I think some of our folks were permitted to be a part of the inspections as well, at least as the run up to the relicensing, but the state's abilities to intervene are very, very limited, and it's a source of real frustration for a lot of people. You know, the Senate President has shown a lot of leadership on this issue because it's right in her backyard, and she's really knowledgeable about these issues and the players as well.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Just a couple more minutes with the governor. You know, Governor, I'm reflecting on what you've had to say about the legislature's response so far to your $1.9 billion package. You've used terms in the last several days like fiscal shell game. They've pretended to fix a problem, and they haven't. You originally, when you filed this, said, will the legislators, quote, have the courage to vote for this thing? And it seems like the rhetoric today is tamped down. Is that strategic? Is it – am I picking up on something that doesn't exist?
You might be. I don't think it's ever been dialed up. I mean, this is a hard vote. I've never pretended otherwise. You know, people take a tax vote reluctantly, and they should. They should. And I think that what the people want and deserve is a real connection between what they pay and what they will get in return. And my problem, as I've said before, with the bill that the House has put forward, is that everybody will pay more. The middle class is being taxed by the House proposal, but they're not going to see any benefits. And then, you know, if people say, you know, they're going to go home and say, you know, I'm delivering scaled down versions, so you know, I stood up to the governor, or whatever it is they say, but they don't actually have anything to show for it at home. I don't get those. I just don't get those politics, and I don't think those policies are very good. We have to be about, and I've said it a bazillion times. I'm sorry to be tiresome, but we have got to be about governing for the next generation and not just the next election. We have got to look ahead. We have got to trust people with the truth and the facts. Explain it to them. Take the time to do so, and then be held accountable. And I think what'll happen if the House bill is the final version is that, and I'll be gone. You know, I'll be gone. But there'll be a vote that, you know, folks will, like I said, they'll be back here in 3 years, maybe sooner. having to say to people, we got another deficit at the T. The RTAs are still breaking down, or you notice there are more doors stuck open on the red line, and there is nothing happening in terms of job creation in areas outside of Greater Boston. And have to explain that they taxed everybody and delivered.
So if, just hearkening back, and by the way, anybody on an email or a phone line who doesn't get to the governor, as always, we submit those to the governor's office.
Of emails on the gas tab at the gas station situation.
You mean the thing we mentioned before? But Governor, yes. Just one last thing. You know, if the issues we've heard you talk about on our show for years and years and years, there's some where it seems to me you think there is another side. The legislature has a lot of merit in what they're doing, and you have a lot of merit, and so it's sort of split the baby. This isn't one of these – listening to you, this is not one of these situations. I mean, again, to quote you, fiscal shell game, pretend to fix, et cetera. So it does come down at the end of the day, considering these are pretty smart people amongst the 97, many of them are, who voted for the $500 million thing. It is about courage, isn't it? Isn't it really about, as you, to use your word – courage to be willing to go home and tell the truth to your constituents, isn't it?
Well, look, I've gotten a lot of criticism for having used the term courage, and all I was trying to get across is what I just did. This is hard. You know, it may be smart, it may be wise, but it's still hard. You know, nobody runs for office to raise taxes, and I am as concerned as anybody else, and more than many. About what the impact is on people who work for a living of having to pay more. But these are the very people who are saying to us, I need a reliable way to get to work. These are the folks who are saying to us, my kids can't afford college. I can't find a way to get my kid off a waiting list and into early ed. Or I can't get to where the jobs are because I live in a place that is inaccessible from a transportation point of view. And so what I've said is, look, we spent a whole year, or nearly a year, building this plan from talking to, and more to the point, listening to those very people, those very working class and middle class people who were saying, don't just tax me because it feels good. Show me what that means. What am I going to see in my life and in my travels as a result of these taxes? And if you can make that case to me and set it up in a way that you're accountable, then I might support it. And I think what the polling has shown is that, as we've talked about it, people say, okay, I get that. And the accountability will come as we do the implementation.
Governor, we'll see you next month. Thank you so much
for
your time.
Thank
Governor
you.
Deval Patrick.
He is with us every month. And thank you for being with us here today. Governor Deval Patrick will send you all these emails that we didn't get to read on the air today.
By the way, Charlie Baker is with us next.
Yeah,
you want to say anything to Charlie?
I'll say hello on my way.
Well, he's actually on the phone when he comes.
Hello,
remember
Charlie.
Him from last time, right? Governor Patrick, thank you so much.
Thanks
we'll see
me.
You in
Take
May.
Care.
We appreciate it.
Charlie Baker is indeed up next. We're going to ask him what happens when a bunch of Republicans get together for a 3-hour powwow about the future of the party in Massachusetts. Maybe they do some group hugs. We'll find out next. Charlie Baker's on Open Mic. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Did you know that the best way to impress an Egyptian pharaoh was to bring him a keg of beer?
Walk like an Egyptian.
It's true. And you can satisfy your thirst for knowledge at the Taste of WGBH History of Beer event, Thursday, April 18th at 6 p.m. And don't worry, your taste buds won't be neglected. Sample some of history's finest brews and learn how beer has evolved over the years. To brew up your pair of tickets, visit us online at wgbh.org/events.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Ellis Insurance, offering personal and business insurance, financial planning, and their online insurance tune-up, identifying relevant risk management solutions for families and businesses. Exceptional service, intelligent insurance. Ellisinsurance.com. and Gordon College, presenting pianist Mia Chung, violinist Elizabeth Larson and Susan Kim, violist Molly Carr, cellist Sue Bay, and more, April 18th at 8 p.m. in the Phillips Recital Hall. gordon.edu/musicevents.
You are listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Fresh off a How to Save the State GOP meeting, we're joined on open mic by the 2010 Republican candidate for governor, former head of Harvard Pilgrim. Good afternoon, Charlie Baker.
Morning, folks, or good afternoon. How are you?
Excellent.
Very good, Charlie Baker. Thanks for being with us. Governor Deval Patrick, who just left here, by the way, said hello, and he was disappointed he wasn't going to see you in person for some kind of group hug or something like that, Charlie Baker. But anyway,
I'm actually a big group hug guy. So
I bet you are.
That's really too bad.
I'm going to ask you about group hugs among Republicans in just a minute. But we just spent the last hour, most of which Charlie Baker was talking about the governor, as you know, wants $2 billion in new taxes for transportation. Fixes, new transportation trail, rail lines to Fall River, New Bedford, et cetera, plus education, specifically early childhood money so that kids could go to school at 3 and 4 years old. Now, he was pretty convincing to me, saying that what the legislature is going to do, and we understand they have to get reelected, they have to go home and explain this, why they're raising people's taxes, but that if you stop with a $500 million proposal, you are going to raise everybody's taxes, but they're not going to get much of anything. You remember, and I remember, how much it costs to get your kid into preschool. It's practically a mortgage payment in Massachusetts. If I still have little kids, I'd be willing to pay a little bit more in my income taxes to get a free preschool for my kids at 3 and 4 years old. What's wrong with his plans?
Well, I guess we talked a little bit about this when
we
I was
did.
On a couple of weeks ago. I mean, my biggest concern with it is I think people undervalue a $2 billion tax increase in terms of what that does to an economy that I think everybody agrees is basically stagnant. But let's put that aside for a minute. I think the focus really ought to be on the K-12 system. And if the governor believes, as I think he does, and so do many other people, including me, that we have big inequities in our K-12 system, and that's where we should focus our time and attention, then he should be a lot more aggressive about turnaround schools and turnaround districts and charter schools and other forms of educational models for the K-12 program. I mean, the idea that you can magically solve the K-12 problem in a whole bunch of communities by putting something in place on the front end of that, I think just isn't based in reality and isn't backed up by the data or the facts.
But
most of the systems that are out there that have done a lot of heavy work in the early childhood ed program, including the federal government, have issued studies that show that unless the K-12 system that comes in behind that is prepared to deliver for those kids, you lose whatever it is you get from having that pretty quickly.
But don't have
this... So I think the focus really ought to be the K-12 piece. And if we want to experiment with some ideas around starting kids earlier who are coming into school, the thing we talked about the last time, doing it in April, setting up some program, I'm all for it. But $500 million to put this program on the front end of a system that in many cases isn't delivering for kids for 12 years after that?
Yeah.
I think that's a mistake.
But one thing before we move on from this, Charlie, that is compelling to me, and I've seen some studies that do say, especially in poor cities where mothers and fathers can't afford quality child care and they can't afford quality preschool and they can't get into Head Start, that sitting around at home, you know, at age 3 and 4 is a real problem, no matter how good the school is when you get there at 5 years old.
Well, so we've been... The last few years, Massachusetts cut back dramatically on its child care programming for all kinds of kids. I sort of feel like we've decided to take this one notion and use it as a substitute for a whole bunch of other things that are at least as fundamental to the success people are looking to achieve, which is to give kids a good start going into school, but to make sure that it's not so much about where they start, but where they finish, that they graduate from high school and that they graduate from high school with a degree that they can actually use. Because they got the education that they needed to move forward either with work or with further education. And I really think the focus ought to there's no doubt that there's more we need to do in cities around education. I think there's plenty of debate to be had about whether the right thing to do here is to really put the hammer down and the pedal down on the K-12 piece or to make a huge investment in the front end and then have those kids continue through into a system that in many cases isn't capable of delivering on what you ultimately want, which is the goal at the end of those 12 years.
You know, Charlie, you said a minute ago that we're talking to Charlie Baker, former Republican nominee for governor, former head of Harvard Pilgrim. You said there's virtually no credible study. The Globe editorial in late March, I think it was in late March, cited this study out of Michigan that's sort of legendary, where they randomly assign a bunch of poor kids to this high-quality preschool, or another group has no preschool. Just go down the list. You said there's no impact online. In school, the kids with preschool, when they get into K through 12, less likely to repeat a grade. When they're adults, they're less likely to be incarcerated. At age 40, they had a higher median income. And many of them, when they became fathers who had gone to preschool, more fathers who had gone to preschool were raising their own kids. So there is some pretty serious data out there. The preschool matters, right? It's a Perry preschool study.
This is the, right, which was done in what, like 1968?
Yeah, late 60s, yeah.
Right. So 1968, Jim, that was a very long time ago. There have been all kinds of studies done since then, including a major study done by the Obama administration that was just released earlier this year, and they all basically say just the opposite.
Well, Obama's trying to invest in the preschool programs just like his buddy Deval Patrick is,
I know,
Charlie.
But his own department issued one of the biggest longitudinal studies that's ever been done in this space about 6 months ago, and it said just the opposite. I mean, my point here is, look, I'm perfectly happy to go down this road if this is the road that's going to give us the outcome everybody wants. But I think there's a lot of data out there that suggests that the K-12 piece, in many respects, has as much to say, and maybe more, about where those kids are going to be at the end of high school than the preschool piece. And I think the fact that everybody goes back to the Perry preschool study, which was done when I was about 12, as their primary benchmark, says a lot about how much, you know, water's been under the bridge since then that says not so much.
Well, Charlie, let's move on. Since you are a big group hug kind of guy, I want to know if there are any group hugs at the get-together about how to save the Mass GOP. And one of the things I thought was interesting that I guess you guys and gals were talking about is that the Mass GOP does a lot better in the suburbs than in the cities, which I guess seems obvious, but I didn't know it. So that's one of your big focuses. Is that right or is that not right?
Well, if you look at the data in the last three elections, at least the statewide data, the Republicans typically win about 65% of the cities and towns, which have about 70% of the state's population. But they don't win them by as much as they lose the cities,
okay,
which have about 30% of the population. So if you win the suburbs, generally speaking, by, you know, pick a number, 55-45 or something like that, but you lose the cities, 60-40 or 65-35, you win with 65% of the electorate. You lose by more than you win the 65 you win by and the 35 you lose. I know that didn't sound all that good.
No, we got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Making,
you're getting,
the point
you're getting croaked in the cities.
Is that the big problem Republicans have, based on that data, is making their case in the cities. And that means, you know, among other things, building a message that works there. And frankly, I think the education message that you and I have just been talking about is one that Republicans should carry into the cities, because I don't think there's a lot of debate about the K-12 piece. Most people, I think, all agree that that's where a lot of this begins. I also think that there's an economic argument to be made there, as well as a public safety argument. And I think Republicans have to carry it there and compete for the votes. And one of the things I said at the forum was, you have to compete for 100% of the vote. You have to go out there and make your case, and with skeptical audiences, make your case. And I think Republicans probably haven't done as good a job as they should do there.
What was the rest? Seriously, what else did you say at this thing? There are a bunch of leading Republicans. You were probably the highest profile Republican. What was your? What did you say concretely should happen? And by the way, I know a lot of liberal Democrats. You may find this hard to believe, not that part, that I know a lot of liberal Democrats, Charlotte. But I know a lot of liberal Democrats who think the legislature would be far more responsive to the people of Massachusetts if there were not just four Republicans in the Senate and whatever is 30. So they'd actually like to see a few more moderate Republicans. But every effort has been an unmitigated disaster, except on the corner office thing. Obviously, you didn't make it, but a lot of Republicans have, and you may again. So what is the 10-step plan?
We talked about a bunch of things. Well, we talked about this issue of, you know, you have to be willing to compete for 100% of the vote and go chase it. We also talked about the fact that the Democrats just do a much better job on the ground than Republicans do. And if you look at the special election up there in Peabody that Leah Cole won, they spent a lot of time knocking on doors, face-to-face interactions. I mean, one of the things that came out of the almost every story that was written about the presidential election is that the Obama team dramatically outplayed the Romney team in the ground game. And
yeah.
Republicans have to commit to the ground game, have to put money into it, and have to be willing to chase that face-to-face voter interaction door-to-door the same way the Democrats do if they truly want to make their case to voters, because it's getting harder and harder to reach people than it used to be, right? And people don't watch as much TV. The TV they watch is typically spread out over hundreds of stations instead of three or five or seven or whatever it used to be. And DVRs have completely changed the nature of what you get out of TV advertising anyway. So, you know, you have to work harder to reach people where they are. Social media, the Democrats are ahead of the Republicans in social media, which is a huge outlet for communicating, especially with people under the age of 30. And we talked a lot about issues. Which issues should we focus on?
What issues besides education, besides K through 12? What were the issues that mattered?
We talked about education, not just K through 12. We also talked about higher education. You know, it's that time of year, and I have all kinds of friends who are really struggling with, especially ones who have more than one kid in college and another one going, what they're going to do to figure out how to pay for it and how that's going to get factored into the decisions they make as a family. I mean, that's become an enormously difficult issue for a lot of folks. We talked about the economy piece. I mean, there are a lot of things you can talk about with regard to the economy that get beyond just the question of what your tax policy is. And we talked about a bunch of those. I mean, I think generally speaking, you have to put out an agenda that says, here are the things we believe the party can support. Here are the things the party believes will make a difference. And we want to engage. And we want to engage with everybody on these issues and make it a conversation about what we're for. And don't talk so much about what we think the other side or why we're against whatever it is the other side is proposing.
Did you make, when you were running in 2010 against Deval Patrick, did you make the same mistakes that people at this conference were saying were the undoing of Republicans, not enough attention in the cities, not enough of a ground game? Are you guilty of those things, Charlie Baker?
I spent a lot of time, actually, in a lot of the gateway cities, a lot of time. But we didn't get much coverage when we were there, I think in part because a lot of those newspapers either have policies of not covering campaigns until they get pretty late in the game, or because the papers simply don't have the infrastructure anymore to send reporters out to cover stuff. And, when I look back on it, I wish I'd just gone and knocked on the front door of the paper and said, I'm here visiting the fishermen in New Bedford. I'm here visiting some manufacturers in Brockton. I'm here visiting, some folks on Main Street in Fall River, and just knocked on the door of the paper, sort of stormed my way into the office and said, I'm here, take my picture, put me in the paper, whatever.
Yeah, that would have worked. I mean, we don't have to go too far, Charlie. It's very helpful, just a couple of feet either way.
One of my points here is that just because you go there doesn't mean anybody knows, right?
Yep.
And so point number one is, I was definitely guilty of not being aggressive enough about pointing out where I was spending my time. Number two, the social media space would have been a great place for us to make a much stronger and more visible case about that than we made. And we got killed on the ground on Election Day. I think everybody agrees on that.
Hey, one last question for me, Charlie, that I thought was interesting that I read about this, the Mass GOP get-together, was that many of the younger people that are attracted to the GOP are much more libertarian and social libertarians.
I think that's true. I mean,
yeah.
If you look at a lot of the folks that were working, that were knocking on doors in Leah Cole's campaign, they were very much libertarian-type folks. And frankly, when I talk to my kids about how they think about politics, and maybe that's because I'm their dad, I don't know.
Yeah.
They tend to be very much those kinds of folks as well. And they worry a lot of, maybe it's because they hear it from me. They worry a lot about the federal deficit. They worry a lot about the future of, they worry about all things that have to do with the economy. Right. But they are not. They don't spend a lot of time laying awake on some of the social stuff.
Yeah.
They just don't. That's not what drives them and motivates them.
Before you go away, Charlie Baker, how many of your kids are voting age?
Two. Two boys who vote.
And if you were running, let's assume we won't ask you this week, we'll try again next week, whether you're running in 2014, and you were running against a liberal Democrat, would you be 100% certain they'd both vote for you?
Come on.
That's a fair question.
Of course they would.
I don't know. I mean, I know they love him, but that's all.
They're not going to vote for their dad?
What's the answer to that question?
Well, I can tell you that I know that Charlie, my oldest, did vote in the last election, and he swears he voted for me. And I got to take him at his word on that one, Jim. It's still a secret ballot.
Yeah.
But I think we did talk about the fact that that especially for young people, you know, if we're not hammering home sort of a positive and forward-looking plan on the economy, especially, and on some of those, the unemployment rate among recent college graduates is gigantic, and they are really focused on that issue and on sort of how are they going to go about making the same kind of life for themselves that their parents made. And I think that we ought to spend our time on that stuff.
Charlie Baker.
I think they both voted for you, Charlie Baker. That's what I think.
No, one didn't get the vote.
Oh, one didn't go.
Well, he's old enough now.
Well, the next time around, you run for anything else.
Hey, Charlie Baker, thanks so much.
I'm sure there are things I can give him to sort of set absolutely curve a little on that one.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Charlie Baker. We have, of course, been talking to Charlie Baker, who joins us every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. Thanks again, Charlie. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, we have open mic with the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGorry. Coming up, I can't wait to talk about this. When is talking about someone's looks taboo, and when is it harmless human nature? We're going to debate that based off something Barack Obama said next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Last year, the mayor of Boston challenged that city to collectively lose 1 million pounds. With just a couple of days left, they've still got 904,000 of them to go.
It's not over until the fat lady sings, of course, but maybe the goal was just too ambitious. Perhaps a call to gain 1 million pounds would have better tapped into our strengths.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the downside of Boston's diet, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Xfinity Home from Comcast, the new home security and home control solution where you can watch your kids get home safely without actually being there, or control your home from anywhere. You can learn more at xfinity.com/home.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie. And you know, we touched on this yesterday, but we both thought it needed fuller vetting. Recently at a fundraiser in California, the president said this about the Attorney General of California, who is a possible candidate for governor. Her name is Kamala Harris. He said, Harris is brilliant, and she is dedicated, and she is tough. He pauses and then says, she also happens to be by far the best-looking Attorney General in the country. And then the firestorm started. Here's Jay Carney, the spokesperson for the President of the United States, responding to that firestorm.
The President did speak with Attorney General Harris last night, and he called her to apologize for the distraction created by his comments. And he did not want in any way to diminish the Attorney General's professional accomplishments and her capabilities. He believes and fully recognizes that the challenges women continue to face in the workplace and that they should not be judged based on appearance.
Okay, Jay Carney, we have a question for you at 877-301-8970. We're interested in your thoughts about Obama's comments, but the broader question, what is acceptable in 2013, whether you're a president, a talk show host, or anybody else? It is so clear to me, Marjorie, that what this Barack Obama said it in a totally casual kind of way, not suggesting you should support Kamala Harris if she decides to run for governor because she's the best-looking attorney general. And then my sense is, and he apparently called her on the phone to apologize, I guess because he thought he was demeaning her in some fashion. Jay Carney apologized. I am totally with Arianna Huffington on this. Did you read her quote about this?
No.
Everybody should relax and lighten up. I wish there was more outrage about the jobs numbers than we had about Kamala Harris. She goes on to quote, G. K. Chesterton. Quote, this is a great line. If there's one thing worse than the modern weakening of major morals, it is the modern strengthening of minor morals. 877-301-8970. Can you make an innocent comment like that about somebody's appearance? Obviously, it was a man talking about a woman in 2013, particularly if you're a public figure or if you work in an office and you said this, and not have to apologize for something that at least I think is a totally innocent, well-meaning comment about somebody.
The worst I think you could say about this is that it was not particularly presidential, because he's the president of the United States. And
he's at a fundraiser.
Really, I know, but he's the president of the United States. It didn't bother me one whit, though, and I was stunned by the reaction to it. That, I mean, he was saying she was a good-looking woman. I mean, that's not a terrible thing. There is a great double standard, or a terrible double standard, I should say, about people talking about the appearance of women that is not flattering. And the classic example, of course, is Hillary Clinton, has been through the ringer on this. I mean, during the 2008 presidential race, none other than Chris Matthews at MSNBC, and they're usually voting for the liberal candidate. Chris Matthews was with Obama. Of course, we all know that Obama gave him a thrill up his leg or a tingle up his leg?
Yeah, when he was on with us, he denied that he ever said that. But that is what he apparently said.
And the criticism of Hillary Clinton drove me absolutely crazy. But this is not criticism. This is saying something nice. So our numbers are 877. Our number is, I should say, 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. Did it bother you what Barack Obama said, calling the Attorney General a woman of great accomplishment, a good-looking woman? Did it bother you or not? Should he have had to apologize for this? Is it the kind of thing that you can never say in polite company? To me, this is...
I hate it.
Well,
the fact...
it undermines to me, too, the feminist cause. You know, this is not the kind of thing that the sisterhood should be complaining about, in my estimation. Complain all you want about the double standard. But in the truth of the matter is, we are all thinking about looks in politics. It's not really fair. But when you look at the people that have run this country or even run statewide, what do we spend a good portion of the election of Scott Brown talking about? How good-looking Scott Brown was. What do we spend a lot of time talking about in the presidential election? How good-looking Mitt Romney is. Barack Obama is a good-looking guy. When was the last president of the United States that was elected that wasn't good-looking? When was the last person elected statewide in Massachusetts that wasn't good-looking? We're a looksist or lookist or whatever it is, society.
Let me just say some fabulous-looking men have been governor. 877-301-8970. And, you know, before even anyone brings this up, obviously there are lines and there are lines. Kamala Harris is a friend of the President of the United States. It was at a fundraiser. He was not trying to make some salacious comment about her whatsoever. Now, there is the moment that a lot of people talk. Remember the guy who was the quarterback of Alabama in the national championship game? And Brent Musburger said repeatedly, he's the sportscaster there on ESPN. Here is him talking about the quarterback's girlfriend who was sitting in the stands.
Well, I'm telling you, quarterbacks, you get all the good-looking women. What a beautiful woman. Wow.
And he said it about 3 or 4 times. He's in his 70s. The other woman is in her 20s. I have to say, I was a little offended
by
that.
But he didn't say it in a lecherous, cradle-robbing
kind
of way.
No, he didn't, but, you know, enough. Over and over and over. I think that crossed the line, maybe at least by a little. I think there is nothing that Obama did to cross the line. And it was when he apologized, even though he didn't say it publicly, and Jay Carney said he apologized, it's sort of PC. If that were a word, totally run amok. Let's go to the phones. Neil, I think it's Neil. Is it Neil or not? Neil, my apologies. In Waltham, you're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Neil.
Yes, it is Neil.
Hi, Neil.
Yeah, so I think you can't have it both ways. First of all, it is the president. So that is not presidential, making a comparison on how good somebody looked. And it wasn't, if I'm quoting you correctly, you said something to the effect, she's the best-looking candidate.
No, wait a second. Here's what she said. Best. Here's exactly what he said verbatim. She's brilliant. She's dedicated. She's tough. She also happens to be, by far, the best-looking attorney general in the country. Take it away, Neil.
Okay, so that's where the problem, therein lies the problem. It's not just like you're good-looking, you know, you're qualified in many ways, but you are the best-looking. You know, I think that's That's not presidential.
So what do you think, Neil, just so I understand you, you think that Barack Obama was cheapening the attributes, the qualifications of this attorney general by throwing that you're the best looking attorney general in there? Is that where you're going with this?
Yeah, I think, and okay. Look, I've been guilty of saying that to people too, but unfortunately, he is the president. He doesn't have a license for that.
Got it, Neil. Thank you so much for the call. Obviously, he agrees because he called Ms. Harris and he apologized.
Let's go to Sarah from Pepperell. What do you think, Sarah?
Hi. Yes,
hi,
this is Sarah. And my comment, quite simply, is: are you kidding me? The president. I mean, he complimented her professional comments and or her professional accomplishments and her integrity. He said very nice things about her to introduce her. And then as his, and here she is, comment, he made a nice lighthearted comment to compliment her, which just happened to be about her looks. It wasn't a big deal. Let's get over it, people, and move on.
Hey, Sarah, what if you were sitting in a room in your office and your boss introduced one of your coworkers and said, I just want to say, I want to congratulate Jane for her 20 years of brilliant work. She's dedicated. She's tough. And by the way, she also happens to be by far the best looking woman in this office.
Well, you can't say that and tick off the rest of the office.
Well, wait a second. Excuse me. There are other attorneys general. Are there not? So, I mean, even though they weren't physically in there, how would you have reacted to that, Sarah?
I think that's different because he's not sitting in front of all the all of the other attorneys general.
I think that's a good answer. That's a good answer.
In addition, it was just clearly a here she is comment. You know, it wasn't, I think, necessarily even to be taken in truth. I don't believe that he was really making a statement to say this is the best woman looking attorney general there is. I think he was just making a nice compliment to introduce her.
Sarah, I couldn't agree with you more. Thanks so much for the call. Our number is 877-301-8970. By the way, Seth Meyers on the Weekend Update on SNL, the weekend after this, decided to comment on this. Here's Seth Meyers.
President Obama on Thursday created a controversy when he said that California Attorney General Kamala Harris was by far the best-looking attorney general in the country. To make things worse, Eric Holder was standing right there.
877-301-8970. Where do you want to go, Marjorie?
Well, it's exactly true, though. If you had, you know, Martha Coakley and another 49 attorney generals standing around,
it
would be a different kind of story. Let's go to Sean from Newbury. Hi, Sean.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that if he'd used a different term, good-looking, it's interesting. If he had used the term beautiful instead, how that has a different connotation.
And how would that have cut if he had said she's the most beautiful as opposed to by far the best-looking attorney general?
Well, for one thing, it means something more than good-looking because it goes beyond look.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is it would have provided maybe a little bit of a backdoor because he could have talked about the beauty of the way she operates and that sort of thing. I should point out, though, that good-looking actually applies to men, whereas beautiful doesn't. So kind of an interesting.
Well, I mean, I've heard a lot of men say a woman is really good-looking. But, Sean, thank you so much for the call. You know how this should have been defused? I just thought about this as we're talking. You know who should have been the first person to say anything about this? Kamala Harris. Instead of the president having to call and make an apology and then Jay Carney having to answer a stupid question at some press availability, why didn't she just make a joke about this and cause the whole issue to go away? What's the answer to that, Marjorie?
I don't know. Did you call her up and try to get a comment from her on what she did about it?
I've been leaving messages for her for a week.
Chris is emailing and saying the ultimate hypocrisy of all this is that people are totally looks obsessed in America to begin with, so why can't we just go ahead and say it sometimes? We uptight Americans go ahead and say it sometimes. We all look obsessed.
But that's a – you know, by the way, the fact that all these studies show that if you're good looking, you're more man or woman, you're more likely to make more money in America. That's an issue that needs addressing. This is not.
No,
this
issue,
is a casual aside.
The issue that needs addressing is the double standard. And this is where women really take it on the chin. I don't mean that in any kind of literal sort of way. As I mentioned before, Hillary Clinton, you hear so many men that are not in a position to do this criticizing the looks of women they don't find attractive. You do it with Nancy Pelosi. You're always saying, look at Nancy Pelosi.
What have I ever said about Nancy Pelosi?
You're always criticizing secretly Nancy Pelosi. Jim, you know you are.
Well, actually, in the spirit of fairness, the show I go with both ways, when I saw John Kerry, and I'm a great admirer of John Kerry,
uh-huh.
I did say to a friend last night that I thought he'd had a head transplant. In any case, let's go to Helen in New Bedford. Secretary Kerry, I'm a great admirer of yours. Helen in New Bedford, you're next with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Helen.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're making me laugh. I think your comment about Carrie is very funny. I just wanted to say that I think it's interesting that there's so much talk about the comment that President Obama made, but not so much talk about all of the comments that Chris Christie had to deal with about people making comments about his weight.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think it's interesting that we're more interested in a comment that is made about this woman, no offense to this woman whatsoever, and yet it's perfectly fine for people to make comments about somebody's weight.
Helen, can I stop you there? I'm not going to cut you off, but just to put a piece of history in there, there are many people who believe that Chris Christie beat the incumbent governor, whatever, 3.5 years ago?
Corzine,
because Corzine did commercials which had Chris Christie getting in and out of a car in slow motion. I'm serious about this, in slow motion, so you could see his belly going back and forth, and there's some pun made about it's a weighty issue or whatever, and there was so much reaction, sort of backlash from that a lot of people think it provided the margin that caused Chris Christie. So in essence, people did react to the weight jokes, for lack of a better expression. But continue,
Helen.
Well,
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah.
But I have to say, this issue reminds me of something that my mother used to say.
What?
Which is that you just don't make a comment about somebody's appearance in public. That's just kindness and polite good manners. And we could use a little more of that when we talk in public and when we talk about our politicians, who, after all, are just people trying to do their job.
Thank you
anyway,
for the call.
Anyway, that's my comment.
Helen,
although
thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
I do think if I ever got to meet, like, Tom Brady in person, that maybe I might be.
You might say, wow.
Just say, wow, or something like that.
Nice
or people
Uggs,
that
Tom.
Are extraordinarily good looking. We've had Scott Brown. We've interviewed him many times.
Yeah.
And you are kind of startled when he walks into the room. You think, I think this is one of the best-looking people I've ever been 5 feet across from. He is a really handsome guy. You just can't get around that. And the thing that I think about Chris Christie that's fascinating, suppose Chris Christie were a woman. He would never be the governor of any place because there's a double standard. Again, men can get away with it a lot more than women can get away
with it. By the way, and Chris Christie, too, he is one of the best at making fun of himself. You remember which night show was he on a couple of weeks ago where he pulled a donut out of his pocket in the middle of a discussion
about
his Letterman, right?
Yeah.
Let's go to Michael in Framingham. You're on with Jim and Marjorie, and we are talking about the comments the president made about the Attorney General of California. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie and Jim, I mean, you're working with a beautiful woman every day, so I think you're kind of like not somebody who should be able to comment. But
that's a very fine point,
am I
Michael.
Insulted? I say I take it where I can get it, Michael. Thank you very much.
Go ahead, Michael.
There was when the election was running with Obama, before it all got caught up in him, one of the competitors, I'll tell you his name in a moment, made a comment that President Obama, or at the time, candidate Obama, was clean and articulate.
Right. That guy's now Vice President of the United States. Are you aware
yeah,
of that?
Yes, he is.
That was Joe Biden in a debate, and there was a major controversy across this nation if he would have called a white candidate articulate. And Obama, if I recall, blew it off and said, it's a big nothing. I'm very fond of Joe. Obviously, he's fond enough that he picked him as his Vice President a little bit later. Michael, that's a good little piece of history. Thanks so much.
Let's go to Selena in Bellingham. Hi, Selena.
Hey, Selena.
Hi. Yes.
You're
what do you
on.
Think?
Take
what do
it
you
away.
Think?
Well, President Obama should not make a comment about somebody's appearance to take a public position because it's not about your appearances. It's about you can do the job or not, qualified or not.
No, but he said
doesn't
she was brilliant.
How you look. But, how do you look like?
But, Selena, he said she was brilliant, that she was tough. And then just as an aside, he said, best-looking attorney. Didn't you think it was just a throwaway line where he was trying to say a sweet thing with a smile?
Wasn't appropriate to say that.
Got it.
She was the best-look woman as attorney general. That is not what the American people are looking for.
Got it.
We look for good people to work for a cause.
Selena, we got it. Thank you for the call. We really appreciate your time.
Well, I do have to say, first time we saw Mitt Romney, you have to say Mitt Romney, pretty good-looking guy, too. Nothing was ever out of place, Jim. Did you ever notice that?
One of the best-looking presidential candidates in our time.
I mean, remember the time that you actually saw a picture of Mitt Romney with a little hair coming down in the middle of his forehead? And you thought, what happened? What happened to Mitt Romney?
No, but there is, I mean,
he
the double standard.
He didn't comb his hair today.
You know, the point you make is there is a total double standard. It is wild.
Hillary Clinton was eviscerated when she was running for president. If she runs again, a lot of people think she is going to run. I hope we amend our commentary. And it was a lot of it was coming from the media. Okay. So, up next. Does split-toed shoes, high-altitude oxygen tents, and a gluten-free diet give marathoners an extra advantage? Or can you still break the records in your old-fashioned sneakers? Loaded up on old-fashioned spaghetti dinners, that conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Figuring out school, friends, relationships, being a teen is tough as it is. And then, what if you find out that your mom or dad has cancer? The authors of My Parent Has Cancer and It Really Sucks have been through it, and they give us the straight scoop on how to cope. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and New England Eye Center, affiliated with Tufts Medical Center, offering patients advanced treatments for all aspects of vision care in 7 convenient offices. Info at NEEC.com. That's NEEC.com. And Rotman School of Management, presenting an onstage conversation on how corporate strategy really works, 6 p.m. on April 25th in Boston. Adi Ignatius will interview Jan Rivkin and Roger Martin. Pre-registration at rotman.utoronto.ca.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Regan. The Boston Marathon is just 6 days away. Marjorie has run 3 marathons. How many have I run again, Marjorie?
I don't know, Jim. Man. But I know you cheated. That's all I know.
Well, I did not cheat. I ran 2 and probably more. I can't remember. Shira Springer.
Rosie
Ruizet. Is the host, a sports enterprise and investigative reporter, has run 11. She's with us in studio. She wrote a great piece in the magazine just recently, Globe Magazine. It's called The Great Running Experiment. Can the right preparation from a caveman diet to split-toed shoes to therapeutic tape really make one person faster than another? Hello, Shira Springer.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent.
Now, Shira, before we get to the split-toed shoes, I want to know, okay, 11 marathons. I mean, this is very time-consuming. You've got a full-time job, you're a reporter, you have a life. How often can you run 20 miles on a Sunday afternoon, you know, before your life is, like, taken over by this sport?
Your life does get taken over. And I can tell you, when I was covering the Celtics and running marathons, there were many times, and this is a bit embarrassing, where I would run in parking garages of hotels and log my miles and my hills that way. I'm very familiar with some parking garages in Detroit.
Oh, my God.
Some parking garages in Sacramento
to
get some hill workouts.
Back and forth, up and down the stairs.
Up and down the ramps.
Up and down the ramps. Oh, my God, that's a great story. So it is incredible reading your piece. I mean, you just don't put on a pair of Nikes or New Balance sneakers and get in your little – nobody ever runs in gym shorts anymore, I guess. And you have to be fully equipped. Does it make you faster?
I'm not convinced it does make you faster. I think it can make you a bit paranoid and neurotic, as if runners aren't already headed in that direction.
Yeah. So what's hot? Give us the 2 or 3, I'll call them fad things, from diets to equipment. What are the 2 or 3 things that have convinced the hardcore, or people want to be hardcore, that they'll be faster and healthier when they cross the finish line? What are they?
Well, I think the thing that's really getting a lot of play diet-wise is the gluten-free, low-gluten, and paleo diets. Everybody, who runs is sort of experimenting with what they put in their body for fuel. So that's where things start.
When Marjorie and I did this, which was a couple of decades ago, to say at least we both ran marathons.
A million years ago,
There was carb load. The Friday night before the race, so the Sunday night before the race,
bowls
you go
bowls
to the free
pasta.
Spaghetti. Right, you have pasta. It's free. You stuff yourself, and then you feel ready to go. What happened to that?
I think science happened to that, first of all, which was people began to really study how nutrition affects the body and how nutrition affects endurance athletes. And they came to the conclusion that maybe stuffing yourself full of pasta before a race and then using beer as a recovery drink was probably not the smartest way to go about training for a marathon.
What's the paleo diet? What is that? That's the caveman diet, right?
Yes.
What is the caveman diet?
The caveman diet is basically a diet based on what cavemen ate during the Paleolithic era. So lots of meat, lots of fish, some produce and nuts, no grains, legumes, and no dairy.
So does that mean no pasta also? Exactly the opposite
exactly
of what we were
the
doing
opposite
for
of
decades?
What you would think. Think of a very, very high protein diet.
By the way,
think of what you could get when you were, if you were a hunter and gatherer. What would you be picking up outside?
Our number is 877-301-8970. Two questions on the table while Shira is with us, filling us in on these new tricks of the marathon trade. Is one, do you have a trick? If you're a marathoner, whether you're running next Monday or not, or a would-be marathoner. And secondly, this one's for Marjorie, because she's written about this extensively in the past. The Boston Marathon, we know, is legendary. We know it's this iconic marathon. But the question is, has it jumped the shark? Is it more nuisance than it is wonderful event for Boston? Where are you on that, by the way? You can be honest, Shira Springer.
I think, I run in it, try to run in it as often as I can.
Are you running Monday, by the way?
I'm not running Monday. Okay. Somebody has to cover the race for the Globe.
Okay.
That will be me in part, as part of the team. I think it's a wonderful way to celebrate the city, to celebrate the sport. I think there are so many inspirational stories, and I think you also have a phenomenal elite field. It's a great spectator sport. It's one day a year. If you can't devote one day a year to allow a bunch of, 27,000 marathoners through your street.
What do you say to a selfish person, a hypothetical selfish person?
Hypothetical selfish.
Who had to drive, across at him?
Who a couple of years ago had to drive from Dorchester, a radio station, to New England Cable News in Newton, a normal ride, 22 minutes, and it took me, a mere 3 hours and 45 minutes. What do you say to that person?
Because you can't cross over the route.
You can't cross anything, right? What do you say to that person?
I say two things.
What?
Better planning next time. And it's one day.
It really is one day.
We live in this time, and not to get too broad here, but, where we have a problem with childhood obesity, where people aren't getting off of their couches. And I don't want to, seem like I'm preaching here, but I do believe it has a very big inspirational factor. I'd like to think that the kid who handed me a wet sponge last year when I was running and I, stopped and said, thank you, you don't know how much this means to me in this heat, will someday perhaps, if not run a marathon, be interested in running.
I've said this to you before, Marjorie. The piece that Shira is saying about that is totally true. Mm-hmm. If you go out early in the morning on the day after the marathon, just the Tuesday, I don't know how long
That's
it
right.
lasts, you see what appears to be 10 times more people running, including many people out of shape because they're inspired. Okay, so tell us more, Shira Springer. The split-toed shoes are hot. Is that correct?
That's the new thing in minimalist shoe wear. I think what's hot generally is minimalist shoe wear. We've heard about the barefoot running trend, and now there are all sorts of variations on that barefoot or minimalist running trend. I myself have not tried that, but I will say that when that trend came out, my sort of approach to these trends is to look at them to say, does it really make sense for my running style and the amount of miles I sometimes log, which can approach 100 miles a week? And honestly, a minimalist shoe does not make much sense for that kind of mileage.
What's the rationale? For those who wear it, does make sense.
Yeah. Those are the shoes, the barefoot shoes, the shoes, like you can see the little toes at the end, and there's almost no
support
at all. I could never figure out with the pounding how that could be good for your feet and your joints and your knees.
You and me are of one mind on that.
Okay.
I couldn't figure it out either, and I do own a pair of those five-toed shoes just because I wanted to try it out.
Yeah, what'd you think?
Not for me. I mean, just my feet, my legs, my calves, my Achilles, everything, the lower portion of my legs were way too sore after trying them out for even a couple-mile run. Now, I'm told you have to adjust to them, but I think the rationale, or at least the scientific explanation, is that it is a more natural way of running and that your body is naturally inclined to run better that way. However, we've been in such modified and cushioned shoes for so long, it really does take a commitment to adjust.
Well,
to
you
that
also, back in the paleo days when we were all running around barefoot, you weren't running on pavement or concrete or asphalt, and you were not running 26 miles for the most part.
But tell Cher what you said to me about this before the show.
What?
That you said that you've always found that wearing split-toed shoes to do talk radio is something that's much more. Our number is 877-301-8970. What do you think of the paleo diet? Are you running in these split-toed shoes? And also, weigh in on the larger issue, for Marjorie's sake, about whether or not the marathon is still what Shira Springer says about it or what Marjorie whines about in her Boston Herald column at least every couple of years.
I've whined a couple of times. But what I want to know about was the compression socks. What about the compression socks? You see people on airplanes with these sometimes because I guess they get blood clots and they're worried about getting blood clots in the airplane. But do people actually wear those ugly compression socks with their outfits running the Boston Marathon? They have their little shorts on and these little compression socks. I mean,
yes.
Look at them there.
And you may see actually a winner of the Boston Marathon wearing those next Monday. Shalane Flanagan is perhaps the most famous of elite runners to wear those compression socks. She swears by them. She believes they help keep her healthy, help her recover more quickly. Mm-hmm. And she is certainly a contender for the women's
What's
title.
What's the theory
next
behind those? That it's more
improves blood flow. Uh-huh. You know, you compress the area, and it just improves blood flow, allows whatever happens in the recovery phase to happen more quickly.
Can I ask a stupid question that I even know in advance is a stupid question? So let me apologize for it in advance. When people rail, and I'm amongst them, when people rail against athletes who use, even long-distance runners, who may use a drug, a high-performance drug that is in violation. Yeah, of course they do. Well, long-distance runners do.
There's been a rash of Kenyans who have been.
Oh,
yeah.
I did not know
recently.
That.
Why is wearing compression socks, wearing split-toed shoes, and doing a paleo diet, why is that okay? But it's not okay if you're not hurting anybody else. If you choose to ingest something, like some of the Kenyans have allegedly, why is that okay and the drug thing is not okay?
Because I think with the drug thing, you're radically altering your body chemistry. This is a piece of clothing.
How about the food? If you decide, I'm not saying it's the exact same thing, but what you put in your, when you do this paleo diet, when you do the hunter and gatherer and whatever it is diet, you're affecting the inner.
Yeah, I don't think it's to the degree, and I'm not questioning the efficacy of the paleo diet. I think it may work for some people. I'm not entirely sure it's a boon to performance. But I think when you are taking a performance-enhancing substance, you are altering, whether it's testosterone or a type of steroid or whatever, you are radically, the emphasis on radically altering your body chemistry. If you're doing the paleo diet, you may be, with more protein, helping yourself build muscle mass more easily.
I want you to know, by the way.
And you're not doing it over a condensed period of time. This is something that also takes months, years, I think, to really have an effect on your body.
You know, one of the other things you talk about in this piece, that in the wake of some report, one headline ran, "Too many marathons can kill," warned doctors.
Yeah,
which
that
I know,
was great.
Now, what's the whole deal with too much, maybe too much?
Older people, especially like people over 40, they're saying it can be bad for your heart.
Yeah, and there are a lot of scientists who also say, conversely, these studies are not done with a good scientific method. It's hard to get a sample size that really accurately reflects people who are in shape, who are running high mileage. I think it's always going to be a bone of contention within the scientific community. It's always going to be if you run 60, 70, 80, 100 miles a week, is that really healthy for you? It certainly seems healthy for some people, not so healthy maybe for others. I don't think we're ever going to have a straight answer on whether you can run too much. I personally don't think you can, but that's because I enjoy it.
Our numbers are 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. You can be frank with us about the marathon. Some people are bored by the marathon. Some people say, I'm never going to watch it again because an American's never going to win again. when it started, our old the local guy, who's the guy that won all the time? Bill Rogers won all the time. Do you find it boring? There's a certain amount of hostility to the runners in the Boston Marathon who don't qualify. It's a qualifying race. You're supposed mm-hmm. to qualify for a certain amount of time. So you have the small number of people who qualify. And then you have zillions of people who are there because they're running for a charity, even though they're like 12-minute milers. I remember there was a big
there a scandal about this a couple of years ago?
Well,
was it not in the Boston? You wrote it? So
I did a piece.
The people that were really good runners got the kibosh put on them in favor of the people that were running for these charities.
Yeah, I think, that was about just how there were some incidences where numbers were being given out inappropriately and that, numbers that perhaps should have been allotted to qualifiers were not going to qualifiers. And there were sort of all these black markets and end-arounds that were giving people numbers who hadn't qualified. Now I think they've sort of buttoned down the practices in terms of how they distribute numbers. If I'm correct with the division of the field, it's about 20,000 qualifiers versus about 7,000 charity runners.
That's a big change because I think it used to be almost even Steven, didn't it?
Yeah, I think there was a more blurred line.
Yeah. You would see these people coming down the street and wonder how they actually made it 26 miles. Because I happen to be right on Beacon Street, down by Cleveland Circle or down by Coolidge Corner, actually. And you see people coming and they've been coming for about 6 hours or 7 hours at that point.
Before we get to the cold shear spring, I want to get your judgment on one last thing. I meant when I read about this paleo diet you described, like hunters and gatherers, I've been on the paleo diet for 17 years. but have not run any marathons in the last 17 years. That's still a good thing in anticipation of possibly running a marathon again. Is that correct?
Next year is your year.
Excuse me. As long as Jim brought up the marathon, yes, let me point out that he has a picture of himself 3 by 4 feet coming over the finish line of the New York City.
You know where it is, Marjorie? JimBrowdy.com. If you want to see it, it's posted on my website.
3 by 4 feet was a tad excessive. I thought a nice 5 by 7, maybe an 8 by 10.
Did I finish? Thank you. Let's go to Phil and Clinton. You are next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Is this our very fit friend, Phil from Clinton?
Well, what alliteration. Indeed it is.
Beautiful.
Hello,
we haven't talked to you in years. How are you, Phil?
It is so awesome to hear you guys.
Great.
So awesome.
Thanks. What's up, Phil?
In defense of the split-toed shoe,
yeah,
I've been using them for about 3 years now. I've lost 30 pounds from 260 to 230 and am running 25 miles a week. And they do take adaptation, and I'm blessed that I can wear them at work training future marathoners. So two thumbs up for these. Two toes up.
And by the way, Phil is a trainer for those who don't know, a longtime listener of former life. So who is the split-toed shoe right for, Phil? I mean, who does it work for and who doesn't it?
It works for people who have some semblance of an arch. People with flat feet, I believe, cannot use them. People with too high of an arch are not recommended to use them either. But for the most part, regardless of your size, they are wonderful.
Hey, Phil, it's great to hear from you.
Hey,
thanks
Phil,
so much for the call.
Thank you very much. And good. I didn't know you were a marathoner, but it makes sense that he's a marathoner because he's in great shape. I'm not supposed to say that, though, am I?
No, it's okay.
Brad,
you didn't say he's in the best shape of anybody you've ever seen, like Obama did about the Attorney General.
That's a handsome guy.
Go ahead.
Brad from Duxbury. Thank you for calling, Brad. What's up?
Hey, I just thought that I'd say that I've been on a juicing diet for several months here, and it is really helping my health. And so it's paleo, essentially, with a juicer. I don't know if you need a lot of carbohydrates from pasta to run marathons. That's outside of my range of expertise there. But, you know, it's really helpful for your health to get away from the wheat for a while, at least mine. And, you know, it's got to vary from person to person.
Brad, did I hear you correctly at the beginning? You said your part of the paleo spectrum is juice. Is that what you're doing, a whole juice thing like cavemen did ages ago and cavewomen,
well,
of course?
I'm not sure they had the juicers we had.
No, I understand. They probably didn't.
They were chopping for a long time.
They were chopping.
Mortar and pestle.
Yeah, that's right. Mortar and pestle.
So, Brad, thanks for the call. It's a horrible connection. So what's with the juice deal? Is that one of the other things that people are talking about, or what's your
experience? I don't know if people are, you know, for a marathoner, it's awfully hard to subsist and do the kind of mileage you need to do on a juice diet.
Oh, yeah.
But I believe it was Brad illustrates is that there is a wide, wide spectrum of experimentation when it comes to paleo diets and low gluten diets and so on.
We only have 10 seconds. You said you're covering this for the Globe, which is one of the reasons you're. How do you cover? What do you stand at the finish line? What do you do?
They have a press room at the Copley Plaza Hotel.
At the finish line.
At the finish line. And you watch on big screens. There's an option to go on a press tent, but because it's such a long race, a press truck rather, and you know, because it's such a long race, though, some of the movement that takes place may not take place in the lead pack. So I prefer to watch the whole sort of thing play out on TV. And then they have press conferences with the winners.
Got and then it. They have that room where everybody gets treated for their medical problems, and you're all in there.
The medical tent.
Yeah.
The infamous
exactly.
Medical tent with all the IVs.
Shira Springer's great piece. You can Google it. It's called The Great Running Experiment. It was in the magazine recently. Shira, it's great to see you. Thanks so much
Likewise.
For your time. Thanks to all of you guys who joined us today. Thanks for the governor, too. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us at wgbhnews.org/BPR tomorrow at 1 o'clock on Open Mic. The editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGorry, and then Alan Dershowitz joins us from Harvard to say why cameras should not be in federal courtrooms. Marjorie, nice to see you.
Nice to see you too, Jim. Good marathoning ahead.
Thank you to all. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow at noon.